Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
All right. We're recording now, yeah?
Yeah. Actual recording is higher quality, though.
Okay.
That means that I go back and I make us all sound smarter later.
Oh, yeah. There's an AI filter that does that.
Yep. The downside with the AI filter is that whenever you say something like men cannot be women, it says that's a harmful thing and we don't want everybody to believe that. So we have to be careful about what sort of input and output you use.
Yeah. But we don't need artificial intelligence here because we have Corinna.
We don't need intelligence here at all because we're talking about gender.
Yes. Anyway, TERFs and trannies, welcome to the Heterodorks podcast. I'm your co-host, Nina Paley, a canceled artist.
And my name is Corinna Cohn, and I use the pronouns she and her whenever I'm talking about a woman.
I use those pronouns when I'm talking about women, too, or other female beings, or my bicycles.
I sometimes use them when I talk about gay men, though, and I don't regret it. Girl.
Oh, honey. We have a guest. We're not letting her talk yet. Her.
Her. Well, yeah, I'm going to call her the whole episode.
Yeah, I'm going to call her also.
Even though she has a man's name. Welcome to the program, Jamie Reed.
Oh my goodness. I have a gendered name?
Yeah, men are called Jamie.
Okay. Yes, yeah, that's very true.
When are you going to stop appropriating masculinity?
It was the name I was given at birth, and it was from, I believe, an actress on The Young and the Restless. Mm.
You were assigned Jamie at birth.
Jamie Lynn, after an actress on a soap opera.
Well, that sounds like a masculine name, not unlike the masculine name Kelly J.
Oh, yeah. Kelly's a man's name.
Yeah.
And so is Jay. Jay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, people using opposite gendered names or opposite sexed names. It seems a little, once
sus.
You realize that your name is, misleading to people and it's sort of lying about your sex, you should probably change it. But
Nina, what would you change your name to?
Oh, I wouldn't change my name. I don't have a male-coded name. I have an appropriate gender-conforming name.
Is that your full name, Nina?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a nice name.
I'm fine. But, I'd be fine if you want to call me Butch or something like that. That'd be fine. I'm fine with any of them. But other people are appalled by the gender non-conforming names. And only perverts have them. So, welcome, Jamie Reed.
Thank you. I'm excited. This is my first comedy show, so I hope it'll go okay.
Yeah.
You're off to a smashing start.
No.
So far, so good. By the way, we would like to say, there's no video for this program, but we would like to say that Jamie brushed her hair for this audio podcast.
It looks great. It looks great.
It does. It looks awesome.
And I know that I told you both this months ago, but I used to really struggle with getting over the guilt that I felt by listening to the beginning of your show.
Oh, the Hey TERFs and Trannies part.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, right. And now you are the beginning of our show.
Yes.
What does that feel like?
I have not appropriated the word TERF yet because I don't know that I actually fit the criteria.
How about tranny? It's...
No. No.
Well, you're TERF adjacent.
Yes. Yes, I'm TERF adjacent.
That's, or TERF aspiring.
I don't know. Are people really? I don't know.
I think you're tranny adjacent. You're more tranny adjacent than you are TERF adjacent.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're probably right.
And you're starting to become a little bit like politically centrist, like trying to call Democrats to the table and talk about these issues. So you're sort of a TERF or tranny adjacent reasonable Democrat.
Yes, but the Democrats are not being reasonable right now. Mm. But I think that they could be if they remembered what they actually stand for.
Corinna, do you realize what TERF, tranny, adjacent, reasonable Democrat, what acronym is made from that?
No, what? Nina. What could that TERF possibly be?
T-T-R-D?
T-T-A-R-D.
T-T-A-R-D.
Oh, a T-tard.
A T-tard.
What is that?
No, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, you just naturally created a...
A new acronym.
A new acronym.
That somehow applies to me. Thank you. Thank you so
well,
much.
Well, you know, yes. Nina came up with a new acronym for me, which really delighted her followers. Have you heard this one, Jamie? I am a...
No.
Well, you know I'm male. And
yes.
And I've had penectomy and vaginoplasty and estrogen. So I'm
And more than a penectomy.
Well, that's I think I said more than that. And I'm a feminized eunuch male. I'm a femme. And Nina's followers were like, this is the perfect acronym for Corinna.
Yeah, feminized eunuch male.
Femme.
Femme.
Okay.
Yeah, they didn't find it very funny on Twitter for some reason.
Nina, do you have followers that are more turfy than you are?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's what I thought.
Okay. I mean, I don't know how many of them still follow me, but
yeah
I certainly hear outrage from women who, well, they consider me groomed by a pervert, a fetishistic pervert.
Yeah. And you posted photos of that recently, Nina.
I posted photos of it?
Yeah, your cat licking your head.
I saw that, yes. That was good.
My cat's good. Not a pervert. You're a pervert, Corinna. Look, you're an autogynephilic pervert. You use a woman's name. You have apparently fake boobs. The breast connoisseurs have declared your boobs fake.
But they're only apparently fake. If you looked underneath, you'd see that they were real. They're just perfect. That's why it's only apparent.
I'm just going to say, I actually think this podcast is going to be more challenging for me to stay politically correct in than if I was on like NPR or PBS right now.
Well, no, you're seeming very politically correct compared to us. We're making it easy for you because we're just jerks. But we should probably use this time to hear what you have to say.
No, it's fine. This is amusing. But I always have thought, you know, what would be the scariest interview to be on, or the hardest one? And, you know, I always think that would be the really in-depth left, which is interesting because it's my people and I would want to talk to them the most. But I almost feel like you are throwing out more minefields than they might be.
Yeah, we're jerks.
I might need to stop for a second because my cat has a piece of poop on his butt. And now he's freaking out.
Ugh. Oh, no. Is the cat going to do
don't
the
stop
butt
the recording.
Wiping
just
thing?
I'm not.
Where
I'm
they,
not.
Okay. Where they go across the floor and
no,
try to wipe it off?
No, he's running away from it because it keeps chasing him, but he can't get away from it. I'll be right back.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's on his butt. And he's like, oh, my God. Oh, I'm being attacked by poop. All right. I'll be right back.
It's going great.
How many cats does Corinna have?
He has one very elderly cat, very senior cat. And no one expected this cat to live this long because he had kitty diabetes. So Corinna was giving him injections every day. And then the cat like passed the age that the cat was supposed to even live. And the vet advised not doing the injections anymore, and the cat's doing well. The cat just keeps living and living. This cat will never die.
And you have how many cats?
I have two cats.
You have two cats.
Yeah. And okay. Cats break our hearts because, you know, they depart from us before we depart from them pretty consistently. So
yeah,
my cats are, I think, 12 and 13 or 11 and 12. So going to be nearing the geriatric phase soon with the kitties.
Are you talking about my cat who's just hanging in there?
Yeah, your geriatric cat.
Yeah.
Are you going to get a new cat whenever something happens to this cat?
Yeah, when they start to go on sale again.
You just have an old cat because you're cheap.
Yeah.
Is that it? That they just cost too much to adopt?
Well, you know, it's like at the grocery store, if they can't get the product out before it expires, they sort of set it near the door. And it's like 50% discount. They do that with cats.
So you know very little about my household, but we have a deaf dog and a three-legged dog. Mm. And when we adopted the three-legged dog, they kept telling us, oh, well, you know, we give you a link to pay the adoption fee. And we never got the link. So finally we were just like, maybe they were just happy we took the three-legged dog.
Well, three-legged dog, that should have been 25% off.
She's fast on three legs. Yeah.
I have, my friends, my god family has a three-legged dog. The dog got hit by a car and lost the back leg. And the family said that they wouldn't take care of it anymore. So they took it to just basically dropped it off. And they ended up with it. And she's pretty fast too. These three-legged dogs can get around.
Ours is missing a front leg, but that, why would they not take care of it? That's okay.
Because it's a broken thing and people want things that aren't broken.
We are all broken.
We are. Maybe I'm going to keep this part and we're just going to have to deal with the cat poop.
As soon as your cells start to divide past we all have breaks and.
Yeah.
We might have listeners who don't know who you are, Jamie Reed.
Okay. That's fair.
So I would describe you as a former clinician at a Midwestern clinic that was a gender clinic that also saw adolescent patients, and that, like other whistleblowers who are starting to appear in the media, you saw patients who seemed to have some unpreparedness mentally. They seemed to have some problems either in their home environment or with emotional dysregulation. And you started asking, is this really the appropriate treatment for some of these patients? And that caused some professional disturbances for you. Is that a fair description of what preceded you coming out and talking about this in the media?
Yes. Yeah. And I, it will be a year tomorrow.
Whoa.
That the Free Press story came out. And so a year ago today was the final edits and the final preparedness and kind of the point of no return.
And so the story broke in the Free Press?
The story broke in the Free Press February 9th, if I'm correct, in the morning. I was hopeful that maybe a couple thousand people read it. Mm. That was my goal.
But it got picked up by other media, bigger media, pretty quickly.
Oh, didn't it? Yeah. Absolutely. And I think to this day, I still think it was probably, I think it's the Free Press's biggest story that they ever put out.
Yeah.
Take us back to that morning, because you knew that it was coming out.
Yes, I knew that it was coming out. I had no real existence on social media, so I didn't I still really don't know what happened in terms of how it spread. I'm assuming it was picked up and shared through Twitter, like I see stories are now. And I know now in retrospect that somebody who shares a last name with me that I am definitely not related to put out a story and wrote across the front of it that it was debunked, I think, within hours. Which I thought was kind of bizarre, since that person actually didn't have any of the documents and didn't ever speak to me. So I didn't know how you could debunk something without actually doing the research and looking at the documents. The toughest thing that next morning was probably that was the last time that the nurse and I had contact ever. And she was a dear friend.
The nurse in the story, this was somebody who could corroborate some of the things that you encountered.
Correct. But we have had different life circumstances that allowed for different abilities. So I'm not the sole breadwinner in my home. I knew there was at least one backup income I could fall on if we had to. I knew we could at least survive and we could at least eat if I was fired immediately the next day. And I'm also not a licensed medical provider. So to be a licensed registered nurse, to have that risk of that professional license to be removed is a different element of risk also. So I always understood the decision. But one of the last things, you know, she ever said was just get this place shut down. So
what was your role at this clinic? And the clinic is known, right? Like you don't have to.
No. Yeah. The clinic is known.
What's the name of the clinic or hospital?
So I worked at the St. Louis Children's Hospital Pediatric Gender Center that was run by Washington University School of Medicine. So it's one of those interesting situations where the nearby university medical school basically staffs and employs the individuals that work in the university adjacent large, huge hospital. I was hired to be a case manager, which is really similar to a social work role. I had decades of experience in roles like that. And I also slowly became the clinical research coordinator and was running some of our clinical research as well in the center.
And you're known for having very, very lefty credentials.
Yes. Yes. I was raised totally by Democrat, Michael Moore kind of class, union-y kind of household home. You know, I probably had heard the word sabotage at a young age. I had a very traditional urban lefty kind of experience. I went to college. I studied abroad in West Africa. I was in activist communities. I was in an anarchist collective. That might be a little bit more extreme than most Dems. My first like real job out of my undergrad was at Planned Parenthood, and I worked my way up to become the clinical manager, and I clinically managed a Planned Parenthood affiliate. Then I did the whole sort of stay-at-home momish thing because it was way into, you know, breastfeeding and bonding, and became a Lalachi League leader, and, you know, did all the good lefty granola hipstery kind of things you're supposed to do. Yeah.
And so did people characterize you when you blew the whistle? Was there a lot of mischaracterization of your, I don't know, your tribal status? Were you like characterized as right wing or?
It's not just me. It's anyone that holds a position of concern about pediatric gender medicine is somehow right. And I do not understand it in the slightest. Pretty much everybody I know in this is not. I've never seen a MAGA hat at anything I've been to about gender, if that helps. I think at this point it's being used almost as a, that's the dog whistle. It's the dog whistle to the other Dems. Stop thinking critically. Stop using your brain. This is Republican stuff. Stop.
Yeah, it's to trigger a reflex, I think.
It is, but then it becomes slightly strange because I do know a number of people who then have started questioning all of the other things that are kind of in the party line. Like, are there other things that we are so wrong, or is it just this? I think that gender has become exceptionalized in so many ways that it's also become exceptionalized even across politics. And so everything feels like you've fallen down a rabbit hole when you start to look at this. And the rabbit hole also is what's red is blue and what's blue is red.
For blowing the whistle, I'm sure people have said that you're transphobic, which is especially ironic given your
family.
Thank you.
Sorry, Nina's an antinatalist.
No, your spouse.
It's hard for her to say the word family.
Oh. I've never heard the phrase antinatalist.
Oh yeah.
Does that mean you
I have, you know how like most people when somebody's pregnant they're like, "Yay, that gives me hope for the world. That's so great." I sort of feel the opposite when that happens. But that said, I've calmed down a lot now that I'm no longer fertile. It was a much bigger issue for me in my fertile years because the pressure as a woman to make babies is very high, even among people who would deny that. So the pressure has been lifted. So
yeah,
my issues around it have also reduced. But that is a tangent. What I wanted to bring up is that you have a, wow, I don't even know how to say it for our listeners. Trans-identified spouse?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And your spouse is an autogynephile.
I was going to say, you must really hate trans. No. You must really hate trans people then. You must really hate them to be married to one.
Yeah, no.
This isn't the trans widow episode. Hang on now. Let me check my notes here. Oh,
no,
wait.
This is.
Wait. Your spouse is female and is a trans man.
Correct.
Okay. I'm sorry. I got
now
confused.
That we've clarified that.
Yeah, yes. But Corinna, yes, remember, yes. Remember, they're just as bad. Okay. They're just as bad as you perverts.
Okay. All right. We're giving you a hard time. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Jamie.
No, it's okay. I don't see the same vitriol.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. Good. That's great.
Towards
well, you get different vitriol though.
You get, yeah.
Well, no, even just towards, adult trans men versus adult trans women. I don't see the same amount of anger projected, but there are differences about safety and space and sports that come up, and it raises way different questions. But I saw a thread by I believe Julia just the other day, mm-hmm. and she was bringing back up the point that if we do not support the medical transition of children and adolescents, then what we should be willing to do as a society is accept more gender nonconformity in adults. And she was talking about the ability for trans women to pass as adults. And what the conundrum is that trans men, for the most part, can pass socially as an adult if they medically transition as an adult.
Wait, Julia who?
Mulata.
Yes. Oh, okay, because when you Thank said you. Julia, I was expecting you to talk about Julia Long, and I was like, I don't think so. Doesn't no, sound I, like her.
No, but I mean, it's an interesting dilemma, and it actually went back to part of my change in thinking when I worked in a gender center, which the initial kind of gut check was this realization, I would not bring my own children here. Like, I don't believe that the care being provided here is good quality care. It's not within guidelines. I wouldn't bring my own children here. Then the next kind of realization was there's no reason why the girls are here at all. No girls need to be transitioned as a child or adolescent. There's just no clinical reason. There was no significant change in outcomes. There was just no clinical reason. And then it all came back to the boys. And I got stuck on that for quite a while, because that does become part of that equation. We are making a decision that then there will be a small cohort of individuals who will, if they choose to medically transition as an adult, they're not potentially not going to be able to pass in society.
They won't be able to pass as a natal member of the opposite
Correct.
Sex.
Correct.
But yes. Let me tell you, Jamie, that the idea that somebody can go shopping or buy a car and be mistreated just like all the other women, or be ripped off by the mechanic, like all of that stuff is so nice. But when it comes to the real stuff, like having relationships and having to get to know somebody soul to soul, there's no passing when you are trying to have an authentic connection with another person. And when you have those sorts of connections that involve honesty and love and compassion, then it doesn't really matter what you look like. So to me, this argument that we can make it easier for individuals, for boys, to pass more easily socially as women does not really help them do the really important things with their lives, because they're going to fall in love with somebody maybe. And then if that person is a man, then they have to tell them, hey, I was born male. And that's going to be a real material part of our relationship. And most men, the vast majority of men, that's a deal breaker. Or they're going to have to lie and hope that their spouse never, ever finds out that they were born the opposite sex, in which case you have a relationship has a foundation of lies. And I know that there are some trans women that have built relationships with those types of falsehoods. And everything falls apart. So the idea that the cosmetic outcomes are so important that we have to take on a very high risk of causing sexual dysfunctionality in these kids, I don't think that there is really a payoff. I think that when we look at photos or look at videos of some of these individuals who've transitioned in adolescence, and we go, oh yeah, they look a lot more feminine. What we're not looking at is how they bond with other people at a very serious and adult level. And it doesn't, like, the early transition does not fix that. I
know exactly what you're talking about, because the final way that I kind of shook out of that thought towards the end of my tenure there, that this was all about the boys, was that there were the patients who had been early, had the early interventions. So the boys who had been put on a blocker when they were right at Tanner stage two. And I was there long enough and the center had been open long enough. So it opened in 2017 and I left in 2020. So I joined in 2018. So these patients had the interventions for the what was considered that crucial period of time. So they were blocked and then they were put on cross-sex hormones and now they are in the later stages of adolescence. And so what finally kind of shook it all for me was seeing that the patients who physically were supposed to be the success stories were not in their lives because the normative things that we wanted to see adolescents achieving, we were not seeing them achieve. And you cannot contribute that all to, you know, people will say, well, it's because, you know, they were still being socially treated poorly. But these were families, loving families who fully supported them. Sometimes families who would go out of the way to make it so a stealth existence was completely plausible. And they were just not achieving the milestones that I wanted adolescents to be achieving. And those were the patients that I oftentimes was being asked to work with more frequently or in depth. And so I was, you know, meeting with them and their families every time they came to the center. And we were trying to do things like establish relationships with other people, things like get a driver's license, think about your first job, think about what your career wants to be, moving on from childhood toys and things in your room and, you know, like growing up a little bit. Like they just weren't doing it. And that was hard to see.
Yeah, they're not really blossoming into womanhood.
No. And the other thing that is challenging is that there is a lot of emphasis on the exterior and things that are very superficial. And that does not get at the... You have to be able to move beyond that. And the thing that I also found challenging just with the endocrinologists and the way that endocrinologists talk about these people was that they were viewing success based on what they could do to manipulate a physical body. And I had the primary endocrinologist would come out of the room sometimes and talk about, you know, I made this perfect breast and it's not cone shaped and it's rounded in this way and it's mounds and blah, 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 blah. And it was like, you were talking about a human. Like this is not, we're not molding and playing with like Play-Doh here or sculpting. And there was so much emphasis on these physical attributes that then the person also would get left behind. And I know exactly what you're saying with the ability to form then those relationships. And what I also saw really hard with the parents of the kids in the center versus the older adults who had transitioned. The older adults that I know who have, in a way, successfully transitioned were never unclear about their sex. They were never unclear about what they were doing to their bodies and why. Adults who transition who are successful in that transition recognize their biological sex, know what they are changing is more exterior and more about presentation and more about how you're being read in society and more about how you can fit in. And they have a different understanding than what we were giving these kids. We were not giving these kids the understanding of who they are and why they are and how this is going to work for them. These parents are trying to create this entirely new stealth existence, but even to their children. And that led to these levels of disassociation too. And mm-hmm. who am I and how do I exist in the world? And it was just really heartbreaking to see how little we had completely thought through how this was supposed to work for young people who are supposed to be growing up.
You said you joined the clinic in 2018?
Yeah.
And you left it when?
I had a very hard time leaving. They wouldn't let me leave. They were pushing me out, but at the same time, who's going to actually do this work? And they were finding it really hard to replace me and hire someone new. So I was supposed to have been fully gone by, I think, November 1st of 2022. And they made me split roles with half-time in my new division and half-time in that division. And even all the way up until, so the Free Press story was in February, all the way up until December and January, I was still being asked to come back to do specific like buyout grant work and buyout time for clinical research. So this was not a situation ever where I was seen as, you know, that I was a poor performer and didn't do my job. It really came down to, you know, the top down was just saying, you have to stop raising clinical level questions about the care that was being provided.
The clinic itself could not have been around for more than about a decade, right? Because this is all pretty new.
Oh, wow. What an interesting question. St. Louis actually had an adult trans center back in the 70s. There was a small handful that were on the cusp, or, you know, they were the kind of the original university hospitals that had started experimenting with a lot of the newer surgical techniques and procedures. So in the 70s, there was a center. It was opened. It was primarily for surgery. Back in the day, surgery was seen as the element that, you know, completed a transition, not beginning hormones. Now it's hormones. So it was opened in the 70s, and there was this initial wave where these centers were growing, and they also went through a process of closing. This is not the first time in American history where we see an upswing, a bunch of centers open, a plethora of cases, and then due to the poor outcomes and the problems with the model of care itself, they closed. So the adult center here in St. Louis closed. When I joined in 2018, I did try to get a good understanding of what had been going on for kids in our region before the center officially opened in 2017. And I did a huge attempt to capture the entire data set. And I did find patients that were going back as early as 2014 and 15 and 16 who were being seen at Children's Hospital in the endocrine division and were being medicalized. So they were still utilizing puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones way before they opened as a formal center. I will go out on a limb and actually say that the care that I saw being provided back then was better than the care when they formally became a center and officially started what should have been the gold standard. Every single patient back in like 2014-15 was required to have a fertility consult with the fertility experts, a whole separate visit. Whole review of all of the fertility aspects that were going to be impacted by the transition. Parents were required to go, and that was completely gone by the center opening in 2017.
So there was at some point somebody very invested in trying to at least make sure that the adolescents or the children and their families had as good as a informed consent about some of these impacts of the medicalization as they could reasonably summon.
Correct. Yes. Mm.
Yeah. Not that they know all of the psychosocial impacts. That's something that we're really, I think, still pretty far from understanding, because you said that this is 2014, 10 years ago. Some of those patients now are in early adulthood. So for that cohort, we're only just going to start being able to collect some data about how these young people are transitioning into adulthood.
Correct. Yes.
But as far as the medical impacts go, they were trying to provide as much informed consent as they could.
Yes.
So Corinna mentioned a moment ago that, well, he called me an antinatalist. And when I was that age, well, I would have probably identified as trans for other reasons too, but really being sterilized alone would have been a reason for me to identify as trans. And I, as passionate as I was, and even though I didn't change after I grew up, and I'm 55 and I still haven't changed my feelings about that personally, I think children can't consent. I mean, I think you can tell a 15-year-old all about the impact that's going to be on their fertility, but I just don't think even 15-year-old me could really consent, even though I never did change my mind later.
Oh, the statements that the young people were making about fertility were sometimes I felt insulting. So they would say, I want to have kids, but I'll just adopt them. I'll just adopt them.
The kids missing a leg are 25% off.
Yeah. So same-sex couples know the challenges of what that looks like, and adoption is not it. Just they would just wave their, oh, I'm just going to adopt. And their parents would just be nodding along like, you just, oh, yeah, it's that simple. You just adopt. Like, you magically are just going to have an extra $30,000 to adopt a baby when you're older, or, you know, go to adopt out of foster care is one of the most heart-wrenching, most challenging things I've ever been through in my life. But these kids, the way that it was just brushed aside, it was so difficult, because that was the extent of the conversation. Do you think you ever want to have kids? No, I'll just adopt. Done.
Yeah.
You're good. Okay. That's the fertility conversation.
It's sort of funny to me in a way, because it's like you're pointing out, I think you said that it's insulting, but it takes for granted that we have all of these unlimited resources. Like, there's like Babies R Us is a place that sells more than toys and baby gear. Like, it's like a Petco, where there's like a little area near the front where you can go and just bring home a baby with you today.
It was just another one of those examples of how blasé it was all treated. It was just treated as blasé. Even if you think about how serious these surgical procedures are that you're talking about individuals. I mean, these kids would just say like, oh, I just want to have top surgery. Like, it's like, I'm going to the candy store on the corner.
Yeah, like having your ears pierced.
Yes.
Well, people do say that it's dissociation, that growing up using computers and playing computer games, spending all this time online, you spend so much time in dissociation that you don't really develop a sense of your body. So you think of it as just, you know, whatever.
An avatar.
A meat car.
An avatar that you can change.
Yeah.
by clicking the buttons. Yeah, we live in very strange times for adolescents.
But also with the fertility, other child-free women like me have pointed out that even when we came of age, 18, 21, 25, we still couldn't get sterilized.
Hysterectomy, even if you wanted to.
Yeah, I didn't want a hysterectomy. I just wanted a tubal ligation. But I you know, had to beg for one for many, many years and finally didn't. I finally got one when I was 33. And I think it would have been better if I'd gotten one when I was 25. But yeah, it's just like not possible. But kids, it's like, why? Why can they consent to that? But a child-free woman can't get.
I'm so intrigued by what some of the stuff that you must have seen in the clinic. I mean, not just with kids and fertility, but what you mentioned earlier too about, you know, the final thing that you had to cross was, you know, you knew girls shouldn't be doing this, but for the boys. And I've only, like, I was a 18 when I started estrogen. And I knew a few other people my age that were transitioning at that time, but I didn't know anybody, I've never known anybody at like the high school level doing this. And what I found for myself is that, like, I wasn't a woman. I couldn't relate to all of that stuff. I had to pretend. For the teenagers, where the social environment is really, really different from even early adulthood, like, what was happening to those boys that had been trying to pass as teenage girls? Were they able to make friendships?
A lot of them had autism.
Mm.
Autism diagnosis or subclinical autism. And so no, there was not a lot of positive friendships or social interactions that they reported or had. When I think about some of the boys that were transitioning in high school, most of the patients that come to mind were either not engaged socially at all. So, you know, think kind of gamer in their room, never coming out, no friend sub, you know, or a few friends at school who also are within kind of that autistic, maybe smaller cohort, but very socially isolated. And then there were a number of patients who were early, this is tough. We were dealing with some trans girls who were already engaged in online pornographic work, mm-hmm. or in chat rooms. And, you know, we were having conversations with 16, 17 year olds about the photographs that we knew, like their parents would say that they were sharing online, and they were already in dangerous situations, and there were already concerns for sex work, and just, it was this very black or white almost dichotomy. They were either in their bedroom, never coming out, not engaging, or they were socially inappropriately engaging in a way with their bodies that was dangerous and concerning.
So when you say trans girls, do you mean
the boys?
Boys,
the,
okay.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I see that with, well, like Kim Petras, the Kim Petras model of the very sexualized early transitioning male.
And it was a struggle, because oftentimes there were visits where their parents were trying to get us to almost like to talk them out of doing these things. Mm-hmm. They were, remember, you know, statistically, though, we still saw this 70-30 split. 70% of the patients in a pediatric gender center are their girls. So it was the boys were definitely rare, and their needs were very different. They just had very different needs. When we looked at eating disorder information, the boys who are identifying as girls had restrictive eating disorders. So they were underweight. They were not eating. The girls who are identifying as boys were oftentimes morbidly obese with binge eating disorders, and they were unable to engage in a lot of good dialogue around, like, they were more difficult to treat, I would say, in terms of eating too. And they also had a lot of sensory, there's a condition called ARFID that we saw a lot, where they would have sensory, it's an autism, you know, link, and they're having sensory issues with what textures for foods. And but there was definitely a cohort of the girls who I thought that it almost would be safer. Like, in retrospect, I feel like it almost would have been safer to offer those kids weight loss medications than testosterone, because so much of the issues with their body were around struggling with weight and being bullied. And for some of them, that trans identification was a way to hide the struggles they were having with their physical bodies. Just very different needs in the different cohorts.
I had, like most girls my age, eating disorder and body dysmorphia when I was a teenager. And yeah, when you're female, you're fat. I mean, it goes a number of places, but it will go to your breasts, right? It'll go to your butt. It's what estrogen does. And yeah, I could see myself hating on that. I mean, we were trained to, when I was that age, trained to hate our bodies. And the idea, it's like, wow, someone will cut this off. Someone will cut off this fat. I remember reading the notes of one girl my age, and she referred to her breasts as frontal fat deposits.
I just thought we had moved beyond looking at our bodies in such a way. And growing up with the waif heroin chic models, I thought we had embraced more body positivity. But clearly these adolescents are really struggling with the messaging that they're getting and seeing.
There's all these social media influencers now.
Well, and then if you think about, I've read a couple studies where it talks about girls are much more sensitive to the photographs and how many photographs of themselves and seeing photographs of themselves. And they analyze these things more, and they are more hypercritical, and that removing some of that looping of the, I've taken 30,000 pictures of myself and I send them out to my friends and who likes them and who doesn't and who comments and who doesn't. I just couldn't imagine what it would be like to grow up in that kind of environment right now. If I was a teen now, I would probably be those, like, I read a New York Times article about, like, this tiny group of teens who decided that they were not going to use cell phones at all. And I probably would be in some weird gang that would, like, totally be opposed to all social media and all cell phones.
I wish I could find a real life gang like that now. Now I'm just dependent on my phone to connect to other people to try to not use my phone.
I still see so much of this is tied up with, what's the Facebook doofus's name who is just in front of Congress and
Mark
he turned
Zuckerberg.
All the parents.
Mark Zuckerberg.
And, yeah, and he's apologizing to parents for all of this. I think they owe the parents with the ROGD kids an apology also, because between TikTok and Snapchat and all of these things, they absolutely contributed to this social zeitgeist that's going on right now too.
And when you describe the girls, it just sounds like such classic, like getting fat is the way some girls hide, girls who are sexualized.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's been around before the internet. That's just classic stuff. It amazes me that clinics
don't recognize these historical yes! patterns that you can see. Oh, the other thing that shocked the hell out of me is we would be in case conferences and we would say, well, yeah, this person believes that they have Tourette's and they have TikTok tics, like literally saying that we know that this patient does not have diagnosable Tourette's, but is having tics based on the social contagion of TikTok. And recognizing that, recognizing the social contagions of the disordered eating patterns, recognizing it when they all believed that we had patients who believed that they were blind, who couldn't walk. There's this whole other cohort of disability being part of this too. And yet the clinicians could see all of that. And then I would say, well, but maybe their trans identification is also part of the same thing that's going on for this patient. And they're like, oh, wait, we couldn't have that thought because that would just throw everything we're doing in chaos.
I'm curious about the culture of the clinic a little bit, because what you're describing is a form of cognitive dissonance where you have all of the information and all the training to be able to reach one conclusion, but there's a culture happening at the same time that if you apply that information, that somehow risks your inclusion in the organization.
You nailed it. That's exactly what was going on. Remember too that clinics like mine intentionally hire individuals who are trans identified. I think if you look at a number of the clinics in the US, you're going to find that probably the majority of the social workers within those roles are, I think it would be an amazingly interesting statistical thing. Let's look at all of the social workers in a pediatric gender center. And my guess is the vast majority of them are non-binary women. That's who I was working with. That's who was applying for positions. There was an intentional hiring. And then what that does is it creates a social environment where you cannot raise those issues without also going down the rabbit hole of, are you going to now be in a DEI HR problem because your coworker can then say that you're transphobic simply for asking a question about the data in front of you and the cohort in front of you. This is why I have virtually no belief that any of these centers could ever self-regulate or actually follow the guidelines or actually ever scale this back on their own. I think it has to be an external mechanism that does that because they cannot do that without wiping the slate clean of everyone that works there. I mean, if you look at Joanna Olson Kennedy, I mean, she's married to a trans man who also works adjacent. I mean, you cannot ask these centers to self-regulate or police in any way because they will not be able to ever do that.
So when people call the gender stuff a religion, it's like these medical centers are sort of religious temples almost, right? Because they're staffed with true
the
believers.
High priests. They are the high priests and high priestesses of the belief structure. And they also intentionally had a grant and employed an education staff member whose job was to go into the school districts and disseminate the belief structure.
And then it produces all these young people who don't really launch properly. So probably the only careers they would find are in that industry of like helping more people trans.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess aside from journalists who are going to have to learn how to write code, a lot of these gender workers are going to have to learn how to write code when all the clinics close. They're going to be competing for jobs with all the ex-BuzzFeed employees.
They're going to be competing with AI. But, you know, soon you can have AI running the gender clinics.
Well, it's not that they do any assessment anyway. So, I mean, the AI can just, if it's, we just write scripts. So here you go.
Yeah.
And just write the script.
Yeah. And the other barely employable products of this system that can code, they're the ones that are training the AI. So it all works. Mm. It all works out.
The future is going to be bright, but that's just because that's the vision happening as the bomb explodes.
I think this week was slightly challenging, though, in we're kind of joking that, well, when the clinics close, you know, these people are going to have to get new jobs. I'm beginning to think this is going to be an even more insidious, challenging process than that. The Alberta, the woman in Alberta, I don't understand how Canadian government works. Is she a premier?
You know,
does anyone know who I'm talking about?
We just talked to Eva Korolova and Lois Cardinal, who they were talking about her, and I don't remember what they said she was called, but I know who you're talking about. Smith, right?
Yeah.
I forgot her first name.
So she puts out one of the most kind, thoughtful, rational concept, like ideas, like this is how we're going to move forward in Alberta. And this is the plan. And it seemed incredibly reasonable. And yet I'm hearing from friends who are in Canada that that the backlash has been so horrific right now towards the people who just think that this is rational and reasonable that I, you know, we have friends who are talking about helping other LGBT individuals who are supporting her policies have to go hide out in like rural areas because the owners of, you know, some of the local gay bars are putting out their home addresses with like hit lists on them.
That's frightening.
So I think that there's just going to potentially be, this is going to be a lot harder to shake than, in some areas than it has been in others.
Yeah. There's a lot of ramifications people haven't thought through yet. Not the least of which, I mean, not to bring everything back to these kids, but the ramifications of what's going to happen when all of these people who've been medicalized at such a young age are starting to grapple with this too. This clinic infrastructure, these people aren't just going to, you can't put them in a container box and store that in a warehouse for 50 years. Like they're going to have to go somewhere. And if they're really true believers, if the thing that they're really convinced that is their purpose in the world is to facilitate this sort of gender transformation, they're not going to stop just because the clinics aren't accepting children anymore. They'll figure out some other sort of way to try to monkey wrench the system. Or they wouldn't call it monkey wrench, right? They'll say they'll figure out some other way to help bring about the greater good.
Life-saving care.
Life-saving care. Thank you, Nina. But they'll figure something out. And we're going to be surprised again. Even if we are successful, even, and I say we, but I don't mean either of you two, because I think each of you has a slightly different position than my we. My we is the people who are testifying for bills that prevent this care in kids. I don't, do either of you count as we in that case? I don't know. I don't want to speak for you.
You mean legislative?
Yeah. Do you support the legislation that regulates the stuff?
Don't you believe we've probably reached the end of the line for what states are going to move with legislation?
Nah.
No, you think we have that more of the map is in play?
Oh, yeah.
I gotta
think five more states, you see.
Oh, this is interesting. I will always hold true that I never thought that legislation was the best way forward, and yet it's the only one that we have right now. But in some ways, I feel like we are standing in the middle of one of the largest car wrecks, and there are cars on fire, and there are people in all different levels of crisis. And some of them just watched it happen, and they're kind of the bystanders. And some of them, you know, are in a burning car and we still need to pull them out. And it's just all of these different levels of how we respond to the medical scandal. I hope this is the only medical scandal that I'm a part of in my entire life, because it's too weighty and too much, and it involves kids, and it's not anything I ever wanted to be a part of. But we're in the middle of this car wreck, and I understand the reasons for legislative bodies. What I don't understand is that we seem to really struggle with knowing what is the actual car wreck. I don't understand why in some states we're focusing on things that are not the emergency. So I don't think a law about drag queen story time is a good law, because it's just kind of stupid. And I think drag queen story time is just kind of, just don't go. And yes, on a local level, your library probably shouldn't have, you know, there's other ways to address that. The main focus to me is on the medical aspect and sports for girls. And so remaining hyper-focused is what I think is really important. And then the next level of focus needs to be on the detransitioners. To me, they are the ones that we are currently pulling out of burning vehicles, and we don't have anywhere to bring them. It's like you're witnessing a car wreck and nobody thought that we needed to train EMTs or have an ambulance. Like, we're so right in the middle of this. I have no EMTs available and I have no ambulance. I have detransitioners who have zero medical care right now, who have no sex hormones in their bodies, and nobody willing to prescribe sex hormones for their bodies or address these urgent medical needs. They have surgical complications. And so legislation is a part of the puzzle, but we also need to be addressing who are going to be the EMTs, who's going to drive the ambulance, where are we taking them, who are the medical providers. We have to build an entire new infrastructure with these scrappy on the ground kind of organizations. And I support so much of the, you know, this political dialogue, but I think it has to start having money attached to it and support attached to it in additional ways. So if you're going to do, if we're going to have a law, we also need the part of the law that provides the medical care for those harmed. One of the things that enrages me so much about the place that I worked at, we had a law change in the state of Missouri. That center was closed to new patients, but had a way to grandfather in those who were already on treatment. And they just abruptly shut their doors. And what they needed to do, the ethical thing that they needed to do, was they needed to guarantee these individuals mental health care, psychological services, psychiatric services. They should have promised every single patient that they had ever seen that we will guarantee you a primary care physician visit every single year. We will monitor your labs. We will help you monitor your long-term fertility impacts. We will help you know if you need additional cancer screenings that we don't know about. We will make a commitment to make this right. Yes, the legislature said we can't do this care anymore, but that didn't mean that they had to throw these people out in the cold with no care. They had a decision to make, and they could have made the decision. If they really are the good, true believers in this is about life and this is about saving people, then what the hell is wrong with them? Then put it into practice. Every single one of those patients deserved that level of follow-up care. We potentially harmed you for life, and therefore we are going to give you the follow-up care that you might need.
Sounds like that's not going to happen unless legislators require it.
Or lawsuits.
Well, lawsuits are sort of individual, right? I mean, if there's legislation stopping these practices, and it's just left up to the medical institutions, the medical institutions need to be mandated. Is that the word?
I guess that's the, this is, so this is the Democrat in me.
Yeah.
So the Democrat in me is saying, okay, the Republicans banned something and they stopped it. Well, the Democrat in me is saying, you stopped this. Now we have to actually put money into the mental health care, the system that would have provided the mental health care, and the follow-up. And sure, you can say that the person who has to pay for it is the hospital, but if we're going to have some kind of bipartisanship conversation on it, that's where these legislative pushes need to go. In my humble Democratic opinion, we need to actually care for the people. It kills me that I am trying to help individuals navigate. These systems should have gone above and beyond to recognize you detransitioned, we harmed you, here's the follow-up care that we're going to provide you.
That when you're saying that middle part, we harmed you, do you believe that the actors who led the leadership of the gender clinics, do you believe that that's something that they can admit to themselves?
I had a conversation with a doctor and I said the phrase, we are harming patients. And the response was, I know, but what do you want me to do about it? So I still do believe that there are a number of doctors who are working in or adjacent or around these centers who can see that those things are happening. I think that some of them do still have the soul and the gut to know a detransitioned individual was hurt by these treatments. And I think some of them could even recognize that those are never events. Those are supposed to be never events in medicine. In medicine, a never event is, you know, if Nina goes in to have surgery for, you know, her medical condition, and she's supposed to have a segment of this part of, I'm sorry, Nina, I'm going in.
I have Crohn's disease.
Do. And, you know, you're supposed to have somebody go in and take out a portion of your intestines, and instead they go in and they remove one of your kidneys. Right? That's a never event.
She's got two.
It's such a bad mistake. It's such a misdiagnosis. It's such an error that it's such a tragedy that it's considered a never event. And risk management gets involved and legal gets involved like right away. That's why when you go in to have like your bunion surgery, you're standing there with the marker and you're supposed to write yes, I'm writing on my own skin that I agree that this is the right toe you're supposed to cut open.
During my sex change surgery, I didn't have to do that.
Wow. You were actually going in for a nose job. You're just just coping.
It was just supposed to be a biopsy on a mole, and I came out with a vagina. It's a surprise to me.
But was the mole cancerous?
I never found out. That's negligence. That's negligence in medicine right there.
I'm glad that you can laugh about this on some level.
Well, you just have to accept it. So I think one of the things that it's not only you, it's a lot of people who've been around this issue, I think, carry around a lot of guilt. And I think Nina and I had a really good conversation offline this week about guilt and shame. And what's that other thing? Guilt, shame. Was there another concept?
I think, Nina? It was just guilt and shame. And I think you were mistaking shame for guilt or guilt for shame.
No, embarrassment. Embarrassment. Yeah. My house is messy right now. I wouldn't want to bring a guest over because I said I'd feel ashamed about how disarrayed and disordered my house is. I've got boxes everywhere right now and bodies. And the...
are the bodies in the boxes?
Huh? Oh, did I say that out loud? Shit.
Do you have some nuts? Do you have like a pair of testicles that was in your fridge?
In my
that
fridge?
You threw away?
Yeah. No, whoops. I thought it was the olives I didn't finish, and no. The detransitioners feel a lot of guilt too, and so like self recrimination and shame. I think at some level, people have to figure out how to transmute that into more productive outcomes. And like you have, Jamie, like you are doing, like you have. But I think that a lot of these patients and families and clinicians and doctors are going to have to figure out how to not beat themselves up, but take the responsibility, but then also try to build the sort of systems that repair the damage. And for the individuals who've made these choices like I have, if you can't make self-deprecating jokes about it, then you can at least look yourself in the mirror and say, this has happened to me now. And there have been people throughout history who've been injured and have managed to live fulfilling and beautiful lives, different, injured, painful, but fulfilling and beautiful anyway. And they just have to figure out how to do that.
And I'd say mitigating, not repairing, because it's
mitigating.
Irreparable
That's
damage.
Great. Yeah, mitigating.
Yes, and you're correct. I have really put some of those, I don't know if it's guilt or if it's regret, but I've tried to funnel that energy into building something that can start trying to tackle some of the problems and really address them. And, you know, one of the ways that we got to where we are is that we silenced and we continue to silence people who are critical thinkers or who are willing to say, hey, this doesn't seem right. So trying to empower those voices, especially within the LGBT itself, I feel some level of responsibility as somebody who's within the LGBT for this. And so part of that is building an organization that can try to start addressing that. But I also was thinking a lot this afternoon that there's got to be a way for us to make it so it's okay for people not to have to become an advocate or an activist. So for people who have been irrevocably harmed or a parent who has kids in this, or we have to have those people know that they don't have to shoulder this alone, or that they don't even have to take on that if that's not what is productive for their own life. If what is productive for your own life is to move forward and pretend like this never happened, or process this with your trauma therapist alone and not ever go public and not ever, you know, I think we have to make it okay that people know that, no, you don't have to put your story out there to be a part of making it better. That you can just heal and move on.
Yep. And I know that particularly in 2022 and 2023, where you've got some like famous detransitioners, right? That maybe there's, and also, by the way, different groups that are trying to get more action in the policy to go forward, that there's a lot of pressure on people who've been through this process in different ways to go up and show up and talk to politicians. And I've even heard from some people who've given testimony that they feel pressured to have to engage in the process.
I don't want that for people.
Yeah, I don't want that for people either, because they've already been through something which is going to reverberate through the rest of their life. Detransition isn't like changing an outfit. If you've been medicalized, it's permanent. Even undoing it is permanent.
Healing, if part of your healing is to tell your story and be public, and it is something that brings something of value to your life and your process, then I want to support that. But what I don't want anyone to feel like is that pressure. And so, you know, I know we don't have a lot more time, but part of what I wish that the people who are attacking the New York Times story knew is how many individuals the author did speak to. And one of the things that I hope we can maybe figure out how to ignore is if activists are going to say, you know, you keep parading around these five detransitioners, I want to be able to counter that narrative, because I know factually that they represent a much larger cohort. And one of the things I don't want us to get into is this constant like, oh, well, we can't have another story if it only talks about these, if it only profiles these few individuals. I want that to be the choice of those individuals if they want to participate or not. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of struggle with that piece because there were so many individuals, but so many people are also not in positions in their lives where they can, journalists ask so much of people. They're asking so much of people. And I also just want to make sure that that's an equal ask. So a lot of these news organizations will tell people, you cannot be anonymous, you cannot use a pseudonym. But then the same week that the New York Times story is out and had that level where they knew they could not put out people anonymously, they knew they had to put faces to names. We asked that of them. NPR publishes a story about a school librarian who has a secret shelf of all of the banned books that, and they were willing to leave that person's name anonymous. And they were, and they were saying, we're protecting them. It has to be equal then. We have to be treating this, journalists have to be treating this equally. If they can be anonymous, the both sides have to have that. And the other thing is the number of records that everyone in that New York Times story had to produce. It was every single record, all of their background, everything was fact-checked, everything was cleared. And then I watched a piece from a major news outlet, and I know the family here locally, and I know one of the things that they said was simply not true, but it could have been checked if that. So the pro, where we want to keep transitioning kids and, oh, it's a sad story that they had to move out of state. Are they also having to go through the same level of scrutiny and actually produce their medical records and prove all of the things? I really hope so.
Jamie, I want to ask you a different question.
Okay.
In what ways has your thinking changed over the last year?
My thinking on sports has changed.
From what to what?
I will say I just didn't see it as that big of a deal, which is a hard thing to admit to. We actually talked about sports in the center, and we absolutely acknowledged that there was somebody who goes through puberty, like that boys are strong. Like nobody denied the biological reality of these kids in the center. I mean, we had patients who were asking for waivers to get in and out of sports teams and stuff like that. We always recognize the biological reality of kids who, anyway, I will say that a year ago, I probably had probably no position on sports and hadn't really thought about it. I think that has definitely shifted. And I think that my thinking has shifted, not necessarily about legislation, but I think it shifted about trying to create a wider tent. So I'm very surprised that there's like a gender critical movement somehow is got all of these factions in it and they get mad at one another and they don't all, and there's a lot of weird fighting that I didn't know existed. Uh-huh. And to me, this is a really simple reality of a medical scandal where children are being harmed. And to me, I don't understand how there's infighting in regards to that and presenting a unified front in that. That slightly boggles my mind.
Well, see, some of the children being harmed are male children. And so that is actually good for some of the factions.
No, that couldn't be. Is that real?
No.
No, no. I'm, well,
yeah, you I would mean, think no. You would think that the women who are, so yeah, there are some, you know what? It's not even that many. I think the very many of us who are so distressed by the factionalizing and infighting, I think that maybe what we're going to do is just stop, is just not pay it no mind at some point. I think I'm getting closer to that. The people yeah. who are, there are some very, very vocal, very obnoxious people online who just love to tear people down for not being 100% the same as them. And we, Corinne and I make fun of it, right? Like they, you know, they're disgusted with me. They say that, you know, I've been groomed by Corinna and I shouldn't call him Corinna because that's a woman's name and just using that name, even though I say he uses that name, he, him, he's a man. Corey's a man.
Okay, but Nina, but there has to be, doesn't there have to be some level of a recognition of reality? The reality is that there are adults who have transitioned. They live in our society. We can afford Okay.
We're trying to undo all of that. We want people to become like in the closet and quiet and invisible again. Make trannies invisible again.
It's, I mean, yeah. So there are people who have, whose bodies have been irreversibly altered, and we have to deal with that. Like one thing that women have to deal with is increasing numbers of women who went through these medical processes, who may be detransitioned now, but they're not going to look like other women. They're going to have facial hair. They're going to have lower voices. And women, feminists, radical feminists, gender critical women, we have to deal with that. These women are absolutely entitled to use women's facilities. And yeah, we got to deal with that.
What if they've had phalloplasty though, Nina?
Oh, gee, then I feel so bad for them. I don't even know if they would like make it to a public women's room if they'd had a phalloplasty. I mean, the complications of that are so, God, what a heinous.
Sorry, didn't mean to stump you.
what a terrible thing that is. But yeah, I mean, there are significant numbers of young women that have been masculinized.
One of the things that happened in the last week, again, in the Free Press, almost a year to the date, there was another whistleblower, and this time in Washington State. And her story had so many parallels to yours, Jamie, that you must have felt like somebody had just made a copy of your story and just printed it and changed a couple of the names.
So the whistleblower's name is Tamara. Mm-hmm. She is truly a therapist at heart. I have spoken with her many times. Mm. I was part of the team that was helping her get ready for the story before it came out. But even I, having that level of knowledge, was still surprised by some of the things that I saw in the Free Press article. And yes, it brought right back up that there are still children across the country who, even if you think that WPATH has a good standard of care, are being medicalized outside of even the basics of WPATH guidelines.
In this Free Press article, one thing that stood out to me is that this woman, Tamara, asked in a training session, what are we to make of the fact that 80% of the female population that's coming to have these treatments have pre-existing mental disorders, and that the very rational response from the doctors at the clinic are, you're not a transphobe, are you?
Yeah. I mean, she was, this is the lack of clinical scientific curiosity. You cannot ask a question that you would ask in any other medical field. If you were in a training about a changing cohort of, we're going to have a new cancer cohort of patients, and somebody says, this is really interesting, why is this whole new cohort all have a brand new condition that we hadn't seen in this statistical, like in this population? The response would not be to shut someone down and bully them and try to force them into silence. The response would be, let's actually look at the data and let me see if I can answer your question.
Nobody's going, you're not a cancer phobe, are you?
Is that a thing? That's not a thing.
I'm proud to be cancer phobic.
You say these, what people don't know is you say some of these things with the straightest face, and you're just like, this is my joke and I'm going to say it. And then you're like,
I'm not, you think it's a joke that I'm cancer phobic?
No, you're cancer phobic. Okay. You could
add. What are you? You must be one of these cancer lovers.
Cancer is life-saving medical care.
You can't use any metaphor or analogies, nothing, okay? But, you know, all joking aside, that is what she faced. And I really hope people are at least no longer standing up to that.
I think it's rife. I think it's everywhere, especially on the coasts.
Yeah, she's in a difficult region.
Yeah. She's not in the worst spot, which I think is probably Portland.
Wait, where's she located?
Washington State.
Just like near
Olympia.
Oh, Olympia.
Olympia. You know, Olympia's a city where former heterodork guest and former friend, Kathy Brennan, was just visiting Olympia, and she posted about it on social media during her visit, and a gang of queer youth came and intimidated her in Olympia. So that's Olympia for you.
Okay. Well.
But I guess the real question I want to ask, Jamie, and you might not be able to answer this at all, but you were part of Tamara's team to like prep her, because she, I'm sure since you're a famous whistleblower, you probably heard from her months ago saying, hey, I think my story might have some similarities to yours, right?
Yes.
Well, is Tamara the only person of that sort that you've talked to since your story broke, or are there others?
No, she's not the only one at all. And the challenge is that to be in a position to publicly be a whistleblower is to ask so much of an individual. And for many of these individuals who have seen harms, who continue to see harms, who are challenged every day in their current roles, some of this comes down to economics. They can't get out.
Yeah.
They have to work, and they cannot find a way to other employment. The other thing I continue to see is that a number of whistleblowers are going to be from the LGBT, because that's who is employed or adjacently employed to these professions. So then you also risk the loss of potentially all of your friends, your family. I don't talk about some of those things very publicly, but this has had repercussions within my own immediate family. It does for so many. And so some of these individuals that I have spoken with and met with and continue to talk to are still trying to figure out their options and where they want to go and how they want to proceed. I think this in some ways is parallel to what we were talking about before with detransitioners. There's going to be some people that it is healing and helpful for them to be public, be forward, and add something to their lives. If you are in a whistleblowing situation and it would only cause harm, destruction, pain, people have to make the decisions that they have to make for their, you know, for those wider considerations. But we launched the LGBT Courage Coalition, launched a website, and we profiled a number of whistleblowers. And it's not just me. Erin Kimberly is profiled. We profiled Tamara now. We're profiling some of those from the Tavistock. Part of what we want to demonstrate to others is that there are others that are here. We are building out networks of support. Part of Tamara's team, you know, was to make sure she had legal counsel. So that's one of the things that we can offer if people come forward is legal counsel. We're fundraising. We're trying to, when you look at what the needs are out there, you know, I have whistleblowers who need to spend time talking to their attorney and they need somebody to pay for the childcare for an hour, things like that, where they can't do that while they're at their job. And, you know, if you're a single parent or you have a baby, and there's just so many things that people need support with to do the right thing, really.
Is there any sort of, I guess, scholarship or grant for people who are in those circumstances to help them? Is this something maybe the Courage Coalition would do if some very wealthy gay person wanted to dump a bunch of money on an organization to help?
Absolutely.
Support
I will take all of the big old gay money that I can find. And yeah. I know that there is big old gay money out there that does not want to give their gay money to HRC and GLAAD and those organizations anymore.
Yeah, give all of your gay money to Jamie.
I will take it. Yeah. And I had another thought Corinna, but you made another joke and now I've lost it. So
it's not a joke. Give your gay money to Jamie. Everything. Why is it always a joke?
Gosh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do have one last question, Jamie. This is mm-hmm. pretty serious. What do you think of alpacas?
The South American animal that...
It doesn't have to be strictly South American. There's North America. There's North American alpaca.
Okay.
Yeah, when she sees an alpaca, she's like, well, where are you really from?
Yeah, okay. These little
have you ever heard of the author Jared Diamond?
Yes.
Yeah.
Guns, okay. Germs, and Steel.
Yeah, yes. One of his arguments in Guns, Germs, and Steel is that the reason why Europeans came to power was because they had workable animals that they could stick a saddle on or they could utilize to plow fields. And the first thing I thought of, God, I'm a weirdo. I'm an anthropologist. The first thing I thought of is when you think of alpacas is I thought, well, they are an ineffective creature for humans to tame and utilize. That's what I thought of.
That is very disappointing to hear that.
Sorry. It's all about the science.
Jamie, are you phobic? Yes. Alpacaphobic?
Why are you asking about alpacas? Do you have an alpaca?
I don't even want to talk about this topic anymore.
Corinna is transitioning to alpaca.
This is like this. Okay.
No thanks to you.
This is like,
I'm not going to now.
At the end of trigonometry, they always ask, what is the one question what is the topic we're not talking about that we should have? Are you going to start asking people, your guests, what are your feelings about this random mammal that.
It's not random.
Wow. Wow, Jamie.
Wow. This shit again.
Traumatized by microaggressions. Not even microaggressions. I'd say this is genocide. This is alpacacide.
Alpaca are social and beautiful creatures.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Corinna's authentic self.
Yeah.
That's okay, Corinna. You're beautiful.
Thank you. No.
I accept you as who you really are, your authentic self.
An alpaca. Okay, now that I can breathe again, Nina, were you going to ask an actual question?
Yes. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Nina.
Yeah, I'll go ahead. I'll pretend this didn't happen. I'm going to normalize
it. You humans just carry on.
Yeah. Are there any links that you would like our listeners to go to?
Yes. LGBTcourage.org is our... website. And we also are running a Substack and we are on X, and I hopefully have my blue check very soon, which I think that means I can make longer. Mm-hmm. What did I get with this?
And videos. And do you know what else you get if you have a blue check that normal users don't get to see?
What's that?
A lot of pop-ups asking you to upgrade to the super expensive service.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, that sounds like it's worth the money.
I really struggled with the word limitations. I think I'm just really wordy. And I would have to like delete and rewrite whole things over and over and over again. So
it's worth it. All the cool kids have a blue check mark.
Yeah, I'm not cool and I'm proud. So thank you for joining us, Jamie Reed.
Thank you so much for having me. I think you're both amazing, and I always enjoy spending time with you.
Yeah, come back to Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hope to get to do so again.
Well, all right, thanks, Turfs and Trannies. What is it?
Thank you.
It's alpacas.
Thank you, Turfs, Trannies, and alpacas.
Alpacas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See you next time, you'll hear us next time. Bye.
Bye.
Hey everybody, thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.